Let's say this, baby. We typically live 80 years ish. You know, that's average around the world mostly. But what if we all lived 1,000 years? Do you think people would care more?
I think we'll be so bored.
No, I mean, my question is this. Let me reframe it. So right now, you know, you're going to live to 80. So, okay, the end of the world might come in a century. Not my problem, right? I'll be gone soon.
Right.
But what if we lived 1,000 years? Would we care more? Because, hey, that's 90% of my life that's being threatened there.
No, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference because we do live for a very long time in the sense that, you know, for people with children, it's literally your life continuing, not as the physical life continuing, but your care about what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, I care about my life, but this physical body is going to end somewhere, you know, maybe when I'm 100 or so. But then someone I really cares about as much, if not more, than I care about myself lives on.
Welcome to The Bridge, fun conversations on culture, life, and everything in between.
Find us where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, then consider pushing the like button or giving us 5 stars. Suggestions, comments, anything you would like to share, email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. We love The Bridge.
Welcome to The Bridge. According to China Daily, giant pandas are no longer an endangered species. The population of wild giant pandas in China has increased from 1,100 in the 1980s to nearly 1,900. The International Union for Conservation of Nature has adjusted the threatened status of giant pandas from endangered to vulnerable. We discuss global events that restoring endangered species around the planet. What do you think? You're Chinese, so this is a big deal, right, Pepe?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I suppose it's a good thing, right? That pandas are not as endangered.
What do you mean you suppose?
Well, I just feel like if I were a panda, my self-esteem would be like a little just less shinier now because like people are not paying as much attention or I don't seem to be as precious as before. You know what I mean? Like if I were a panda. Sure. But it's good news, right? It's just that the increase isn't as great as I thought.
Oh my gosh, I can't get enough pandas. I've been to Chengdu. I went to the panda reserve and I need to go back to see more pandas.
From the 1980s to now, that's 40 years. In the span of 40 years, only 800 more. So that still means that the amount is pretty small. I don't know when will be the day when each of us can, you know, adopt a panda if we wanted to.
I would assume that it would be considerably more than just 800 more. Yes, I think you're right. You know, only an 800 increase in their population. I guess it's difficult to breed them, you know? So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I just read somewhere, the book was like talking about, that part was talking about energy and stuff. Mm. So pandas used to be carnivores, like they used to eat meat.
Really?
Somewhere along the way.
Vicious.
Yeah,
pandas.
I think they might still do, but somewhere along the way, they became herbivores.
Wow.
Or they mostly just eat bamboo leaves.
Yeah.
And not just any kind of herbivore, but just like, that's the only thing I eat.
You know,
but actually, that's not true. They
do
eat like other stuff.
Yeah, I've seen them eat watermelon and stuff in videos.
Apples and, but still, the things
like
they eat
primary.
Are low in calories.
Oh.
Yeah, low in calories. So they have to be like constantly eating. I mean, you know, imagine that we have to eat like constantly. If we had to spend like 8 hours a day just to.
Man, I want to be a panda now.
Well, but then you won't have the energy to do other stuff like.
Oh, yeah.
Procreate.
All I do is eat and sleep. Oh my gosh, that's like perfect for Jason.
But would you like to eat just like, you know, pumpkins and apples and like a little bit of milk on the side and apples? Like no
other.
Well,
here's the thing, you know,
potato chips.
If that's all I want, right? Let's just take an example. Let's just say all I got to eat for the rest of my life was prime rib steak or something.
Oh,
I'd be happy.
Well, but that's not. If that were the case, you only need to eat like one meal a day. You know,
yeah.
That will like
be
enough for the calories.
Do pandas think like, wow, this bamboo is good? When they're munching on it, they're like, oh my god, bamboo.
I don't know. Maybe. Well. I got to say that. Have you ever tried bamboo shoots?
Oh, yeah. They have them in,
you know, like
a
stir-fried.
Yeah, yeah.
They have them here in China. Yeah, I was surprised you guys eat bamboo.
Very good.
Well, you know, it's not just in stir fry. They have it in a, they have the soft bamboo in, what is it called? Malatang, where you put all your stuff into a bowl and you hand it to the professionals. They boil it for you and they give it back to you with like spicy sauce and stuff.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, that's the first time I ever tried eating bamboo myself. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't spectacular.
Right. Either. So the bamboo shoots themselves, they don't really have any taste. Right. But then they've got this interesting texture. They're a little bit like hearts of palm. Have you ever had those?
Yeah.
So they don't really taste like anything. But then somehow, like mysteriously, you just feel like eating it. Like it's the texture or the slight taste. And also like artichokes. I mean,
yeah,
let's be honest, as a kind of like food, it shouldn't even like survive to this day. Because it's like so not productive.
I'm wondering though, who's the first person who saw that and thought, yeah, no, that's going to be good if I, you know.
Well, it must have been someone who was really starving and patient at the same time. Like it kept peeling and peeling and peeling and not lose heart. And eventually it got to the heart of the artichoke, which I think it tastes great. I mean, I don't think it even has a taste.
You know, you can eat part the leaves too,
well,
right?
Well, they will be dry.
The part of the leaves. Well, no, in America, my mom would do this. This is how we, because artichokes is a huge family thing we would do once a month or something. Ooh. You boil the artichoke or steam it, you know, until it's really soft. And then you peel one leaf off at a time. You can eat about 15% of that leaf. And so you eat that.
I know. But let me tell you, like for a regular Chinese person, this whole process, like it's hard to make sense. Like they'll be like, there are like a million other type of food to eat on the planet or in the supermarket, at least hundreds, right? They'll be like, why would anyone eat this? This is so inefficient. And I think it's probably pretty pricey too.
What are those seeds that all Chinese people eat in a big bag and they're all different flavors and stuff? My wife eats them all the time. Like
seeds?
There's a kind of like, it cracks open from a little shell and she spends a lot of time like nibbling through these like shells.
Pine nuts?
Yeah, I'm not even sure, but she eats these all the time and it's also inefficient. I think they're roughly the same degree. Anyways, we're supposed to be talking about
endangered species.
Endangered species. So this is fortune.com. This is from February 12th. Nearly half of all world's migratory species are in decline. And that's, half. And more than a fifth face extinction. So we're looking at 20% of all migratory species on the planet are going to be gone in a decade or two.
Wow.
According to the United Nations. So that is a lot. And it has an enormous amount of, the article talks about all kinds of species that you wouldn't think are migratory. For example, giant gorillas. Giant gorillas are actually migratory. They move around. And so they're a migratory species. So when they say they're not just talking about birds. They're talking about all kinds of animals that are in, you know, because here's the thing. If you're an animal and you migrate to like 10 places a year, right? Mm. But two of those no longer can support you with calories.
Right.
You can no longer migrate.
Mm.
That just disrupts your entire system, your entire species way of life.
That makes sense.
And so for a lot of species, that's it. Mm-hmm. One ecosystem or two ecosystems, part of their migratory, you know, annual trip, they're gone.
Mm. You know, when I saw this topic, endangered species, you know what I thought of? Like, what was the first thought that came into my mind? Mm. That we are an dinosaurs. Endangered species. Yeah. We, in a way. Yeah, seriously. Like, because things might happen that can just in one puff of, I don't know, smoke or whatever, destroy, like, all of us. And I don't know how close we are to that point. Because, like, things are really just hanging in the balance. I mean, the details we're talking about now, you know, species are declining. It's a real, it's a real threat. But as I was reading more about this, there is also this sense of frustration because how we respond to distant possibilities, you know, because we think that's distant. Like, what does that have to do with me? You know, some migratory birds or turtles can't seem to find a new home. But like, where are they? You know, it's not in my neighborhood. It's not cutting into my profit. So we don't care as much, like in a real sense. And like humans need some real threats to make us change our behavior. Like I keep thinking.
Threaten them, baby.
I do threat like one human being. That's my daughter. Well, I've been trying not to do so. The reason why I'm talking about this is I notice, you know, how she behaves. or how we, when we were little kids, behaves. Like, she will not change her behavior until there is like immediate threats. If it is in the distance, like, I'm going to do this 2 hours later, she will loaf around for like an hour and 59 minutes until the last minute she senses that, oh, something is coming. And we as adults kind of do the same thing, right? We feel like, oh, climate disaster. You know, yeah, people talk about it all the time, but where is it? You know, we don't wake up until the moment like some tornado knocks on your door. Or like, you know,
well, I got an interesting question.
Sure.
Let's say this, baby. We're, you know, we typically live 80 years ish. You know, that's average around the world mostly. But what if we all lived 1,000 years? Do you think people would care more?
I think we'll be so bored.
No, I mean, my question is this. Let me reframe it. So right now, you know, you're going to live to 80. So, okay, the end of the world might come in a century. Ah, not my problem, right? I'll be gone soon.
Right.
But what if we lived 1,000 years? Would we care more? Because, hey, that's 90% of my life that's being threatened there.
No, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference because we do live for a very long time in the sense that, in the sense that, you know, for people with children, that's your, it's literally your life continuing, not as like, not as the physical life continuing, but your care about what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, I care about my life, but this physical body is going to end somewhere, you know, maybe when I'm 100 or so. But then someone I really cares about as much, if not more than I care about myself, lives on. So it should make a difference. It should be the same, not more threatening, you know, to know that my daughter will suffer from the pile of garbage that is piling up untreated somewhere. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, we are living like 1,000 years or 2,000, depending on how long this whole environment can sustain us. So yeah, and also, you know, I was reading these articles, and at first in one of them, it said the United States is has lost over 50 species in the last century. And upon first reading it, I read it wrong. I was like, I read it as the United States lost 50% of its species in the last century. I was like, oh my goodness, you know, if you go on at that rate, you know, we are down the line. Okay, so 50 species is better than half of the species.
I'd like to add something interesting. You know, one of the reasons this is an interesting topic for us to talk about as the bridge, right, is that Susan Lieberman, Vice President of International Policy at Nonprofit Wildlife Conservation Society, I know that's a mouthful, said, quote, "One country alone cannot save any of these species," end quote, when she's talking about the 1,200 species, 44% of which are, you know, potentially facing extinction, and they're all migratory. The reason being, you know, birds in China end up in Vietnam and you know, they end up in other countries, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, India. So, like, if we're going to save migratory species, we need to work across borders. We need nations to get together and protect their own environments in concert with other nations protecting their own environments. If one country does its job to save a migratory species and another doesn't, you still lose it.
You know how ironic this seems at this moment in history? Is that, you know, we're talking about saving the future of migratory birds across, you know, through cooperation across nations. But at the same time, humans living in different nations are killing each other. You know, in wars, we are killing other humans. And at the same time, there are other people who care so much, you know, about the fate of birds. I just like, I almost can't get my head around this. Like, the crazy things that we are doing, you know, like, caring about the future of migratory birds is important enough. But at the same time, human lives, we're killing each other in a way. But okay, anyhow, I don't want to make it sound too crazy.
No, I understand what you're saying. You know, what's interesting about that is, yes, we absolutely 100% should put, you know, humans first. But in a way, by protecting the global environment, we are putting humans first. Because if we lose some key species, we could we could be killing humanity. Like you mentioned earlier, a puff of smoke.
Right. That's not what
one,
I was.
One animal.
That's not what I meant. I didn't feel like I didn't mean to put humans above other species. I'm just saying the severity of the problem, you know, with our human consciousness, you know, Like, it's equally important, I think, because it's all lives, whether it's migratory species or humans. It's just like we are, in a way, really crazy now, the things we do. Hmm. You know, like our the health state of our consciousness has been manifested in the things that's happening around the world. But okay, coming back to our main topic. So declining mm-hmm. of species, especially migratory, because they have to travel such a long time. You mentioned that how one nation can't really help it. I was trying to think of maybe there are certain species that like one nation can work or protect on its own. For example, like pandas in China. And I think, you know, China has been doing a great job. And also there are a lot mm-hmm. of species that are unique and also like mm-hmm. living in one place. For example, I think in Australia, because in a way it's so isolated, right, from other continents, they have some really, you know, cute and special animals that mm-hmm. live only, pretty much only in natural environments on that continent. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they will also, you know, do a better job protecting them.
Well, you know, I think a lot of nations around the world are, in fact, trying to protect species. I know in the United States, there's an enormous effort to protect all kinds of species. And there's all kinds of different people, millions of people doing their part to protect different ecosystems, different environments. You and I recently talked about wetlands. Mm-hmm. So I think there are a lot of indigenous species around the world in China, in Europe, in the United States, in Africa, where there's a lot of effort globally even to protect different right. kinds of species. One thing that's concerning about migratory species is it only takes one ecosystem in one place. So let's just pretend there's a country. Well, I'm not going to say any names. We're just going to theorize a country.
Choclita country. Let's call it that.
Sure. So it has a mountain that it wants to mine ore from. And this mountain is critical to some migratory species. If they decide to continue to mine that ore, they're going to wipe out a link in that migratory species chain. And so by mining that ore, they destroy the entire species. Maybe that species exists for thousands of miles and covers five or six countries. But if one single ecosystem goes down, we lose it. And there's an interesting another quote by Duke University ecologist Stuart Pym, which says, quote, migration is essential for some species. If you cut the migration, you kill the species. So like, you know, one single place in the linkage of their ecosystem is gone. That species is gone. So we really need to be working in concert with one another. I mean, I agree. Mm-hmm. There are local initiatives to say local species. The problem mm-hmm. with migratory species, which may be critical for, you know, in ways that we don't understand. We humans like to think that we're really smart, but that we're always finding out things that shock us about the way that the world works, the way that science works, the way that ecology works. What if mm-hmm. we lose some critical bird we had no idea was like, you know, a linchpin of the global human or the global ecosystem? You know, we don't even know what we're messing with. We say we may lose 20% of 1,200 migratory species. That could be really, you know, overwhelming in other ways. What if those birds or, you know, gorillas are eating something without them would overrun, you know, a couple of countries?
Yeah, I read it somewhere that losing one species, like we might not feel the impact of it, but it's when things adds up. And you start losing like more and a bigger area of crucial importance to the ecosystem. And somewhere the scale tips and it goes into an out of balance mode. But then by that time, it will be hard to tip it back. You know, it's like when people get sick, you don't get sick all of a sudden, right? Unless you like run over by something. But like normal diseases, it's like it has been building up. It's just that our senses are not sensitive enough to pick up the signals, or in a way, we are not as conscious enough of what's going on at the microscopic level. So we are like blind to these things. And even when articles and videos and podcasts tell us that science has proven that these are the case, we're still kind of like, yeah, I don't see it, I don't feel it, and that it's not happening. That's a real flaw with our way of living, because we're so limited by our senses. We don't see it. I mean, in English, we have the saying, seeing is believing, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And in Chinese, we have something similar. That is such a flawed way of living one's life.
Yeah.
Because we only see so little. And then our whole map of existence is like so blurry beyond imagination. But we take it to be real and we live by it. And that's why like terrible things happen, because we just don't get the real map. I mean, there are ways where, you know, the thing we're doing now, we're telling you this is what happens and we're giving you a clearer map, giving ourselves a clearer map. Like last time we talked about wetlands. I did not know that. Like in my personal map of the world, wetlands do not exist. Mm. It's just like, what's wetland? Like wetlands doesn't sound very interesting, right? I don't feel like going to places like that. But then after I learned about what it does to the whole system, like if we want clean water, if we want our water to be filtered properly, and if we don't want as many floods or droughts, then we got to keep our wetlands healthy. Mm. And just interestingly, on our way back from our New Year's, Chinese New Year's trip, mm-hmm. we ended up in one city and they actually had a wetland park.
Wow.
Like back in the days, I wouldn't even notice. Like, I'm not interested.
You get muddy shoes there?
yeah, but it's worth it, right? And I feel like the time yeah. that I was there, I knew that, wow, this is like a healthy lung breathing, you know, for the whole environment. It didn't seem so, pointless before, because there were no interesting like structures on top of it. It's just like natural land. Mm. Now I know it's a good thing. So yeah, remember the limit of our senses and try to go beyond that to paint a better map.
I think it's a really good point. Also, I mean, seeing and believing is interesting because you can become an expert in your life in a few things. But, you know, those few things, if you look at the whole of what is able to be known just by living on this earth, it's nothing. It's practically immeasurable. Like, it cannot be measured because it is so tiny compared to the wealth of human knowledge, but also the things that we don't know. So what we don't know is way bigger than what we do know, even as a species, even if you put all human knowledge together. So, like, you know, we're getting dark. I want to go bright a little.
We're getting dark.
This is from English.news.cn, and it's written by senior editor Hua Xia. Endangered Chinese mergansers. I don't know. This is kind of bird.
Yeah.
Spotted wintering in southwest China's Guizhou. Mm. So they say they look out for these in the article, and that they are living fossils with wings because they are also under protection by the government. But they are being spotted, and that this is a sign that attempts to protect their Beipanjiang Grand Canyon National Wetlands Park, which is a wetlands, is doing well because this bird is being spotted periodically and more throughout the years. So it looks like the efforts that have gone into protecting this wetlands have, in fact, ensure that this species is reproducing and is continuing to thrive in that environment.
That's really good news, not just for this one species, but in the way that people have changed their view of, you know, animals such as ducks. I guess back in the days when people just, you know, thought of ducks as food, you know, now people are not celebrating because we have, you know, one more new dish. We're celebrating when we see, you know, the bird in nature. You know, we're welcoming the bird living its own life happily in nature. So I think that's something, it's even worth more to celebrate. Is that how you would say it? Yeah,
sure,
I guess.
Sure.
Anyhow, so I've never heard of this bird until like now. And its Chinese name is Qiu Sha Ya, like autumn sand duck. So, well, I'm happy that it's back in our environment. And also because the reemergence of this bird, I think there are many other species, maybe smaller in scale, that came back with it, that you just don't see them because, you know, it's just...
It does mention at the end of the article, researchers have also spotted other bird species, such as the cormorant pond heron, crested kingfisher.
Wow.
So there are other species that are threatened. You know, what's interesting about this, and we've talked about this before, is China now has a national park system, mm-hmm. very similar to the U.S. park system, where certain areas of just absolute, you know, wondrous beauty and nature have been cordoned off. And you're like, okay, there are no malls that were shopping centers going here. Mm-hmm. And so that's fantastic. I think, you know, and a lot of countries are following suit around the world and protecting critical parts of our ecosystem. The problem is it's not happening everywhere that is necessary. And there are, in fact, places that are critical infrastructure for our ecology. We think of critical infrastructure as a, you know, human logistics supply chain for goods and Amazon stuff, right? Mm. But there's also the other side of that. You know, what do species need in order to keep our global ecological architecture thriving? And well, some of that is, you know, under serious threat because, hey, that mountain's got ore in it. We want.
That's a good point because the primary culprit for endangered species is habitat loss. Like they don't have enough place to live because humans have taken up so much of it. Oh,
yeah. You're listening to The Bridge.
Here is an article I want to share. It's from earth.org. And the name is Lost Species, Lost Species, The Impact of Habitat Destruction in the U.S. So it was from this article that I read that the U.S., a wealthy and industrialized corner of our planet, lost over 50 species in the last century.
Wow.
A little bit more detail. Species loss in the U.S. animal populations worldwide have declined by 70%.
Wow.
What? In last 50 years. Can you believe this? In last half a century. This is according to a WWF report. And then in 2023, U.S. scientists declared 21 species officially extinct. And they include mammals, birds, mussels, and fish. And destroyed habitats was identified as the key factor. And there are currently 1,300 U.S. animals in endangered or threatened status. So that sounds pretty serious. And the primary reason is, as I mentioned, habitat lost because of the incessant needs of modern society that keep pushing, you know, keep pushing the original residents into smaller and smaller patches of land and making the ones they inhabit now more unfriendly than before. And so their ongoing pressure to repurpose conservation lands for profitable crops, you know, growing things that humans like to eat or growing, I don't know, crops for animals that humans like to eat. And we are really on the top of the food chain here. And also urbanization persists, transforming wildlife habitats into housing developments like roads and industrial sites. And I understand that everyone needs a place to live, but do they all have to be that big? You know, I think, and also water development disrupts natural flows. For example, the Colorado River experiences depletion during dry seasons. So there are certain periods of the year where the river dries up. And I think that's probably happened to a lot of rivers, both in China and some other countries. And also on top of that, there's pollution, which impacts freshwater ecosystems with untreated sewage water, mining waste, chemicals concentrating in rivers and lakes. And we don't like them. Other species don't like them either. And their survival, they don't have filters. You know, they don't, it's not like they can boil it or filter it before drinking it. And also on top of all that, there's climate change, which is a growing contributor to habitat loss. So yeah, if you don't have a place to live.
I'm feeling sad again.
Well, something bright.
I've got something bright. Okay.
Sure.
I know this is not going to fix everything you just said. So I'm going to feel sad for a long time. But in Beijing, there's something really cool that I think a lot of people should come see. If you're coming to Beijing, you know, it's actually hard to see without a drone or something. But in North Beijing, not as far north as Beibei is, but around the Olympic Park, there's a place called the Olympic Park and Olympic Park North. These are two huge cordoned off areas that are surrounded by, you know, roads, massive roads cars everywhere, three lanes on both sides, but they're also in and of themselves gigantic parks with little lakes and stuff. Mm-hmm. What's really fascinating is I went to the Olympic Park North one time and I got out of the car that dropped me off there and I thought, oh no, I went to the wrong Olympic Park. I need to go to Olympic Park South, mm-hmm. but I'll just walk around and see what's here. And after about an hour of walking around exploring, I was in Olympic Park South mm-hmm. and I was kind of surprised by this. So I looked at the map and there really is a land bridge. And this is something that a lot of countries are starting to build around the world mm-hmm. where there is a bridge that goes over the highway mm-hmm. and connects the two parks, but it is so seamlessly integrated into the landscaping that you don't even notice that you're crossing over the highway. It's just this very wide bridge that is super massively wide and just goes over the highway. And so animals, mm-hmm. frogs, birds, you know, whatever, they can just go over the land bridge from the South Olympic Park to the North Olympic Park. Mm. And it for them, it's just one gigantic park for them to play in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool. We should have more things like that. Because some animals might be cut off by a highway.
Right.
You know, this is cutting me off from my water supply or my food supply
exactly.
or, you know, some place I go in the winter. And so these land bridges are a great way to reintegrate the natural order of the landscape around the human interventions.
So can you imagine, like, let's say you go to work, you know, you walk to work or you bike to whatever. And one day you wake up and to find that that road is gone. Like no one told you,
yeah.
but then it's just like blocked or it's just like there's a building on it, right? And for them, they live on a different scale. Like say you mentioned a frog. Yeah. One day they wake up, they feel like, oh my gosh, I'm cut off from my aunt's family, aunt's house forever, right? What about my buddy? Yeah. He's still like way over there. I can like this lifetime, I'm not going to see him again, right? So that would be a dramatic change. So yeah, let's just be a little more considerate. And this is one way.
You know, this is a silly story and I don't know why I'm telling it, but I think it's interesting. In the fall, I go to these parks around here on Beijing West and there are always these walking paths designed for me to go mm-hmm. walking around, listening to music, you know, to make sure I don't get too fat. And like I see in the fall, these worms crawling out of the ground and struggling to get across the pavement to wherever they want to go.
Right.
And as I'm walking along, I carry a leaf with me so I can scoop them up and put them on the side they're trying to go to.
Thank you so much.
I can't always. Oftentimes, they're already dry by the time I get there. And I'm like, oh, no, my morning jogging path is killing the worms. And I feel so bad about that.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Now I remember another story. It's a friend of mine. So I think he was like trekking in the wild or something. And he saw like a turtle going in the direction of the river, like somewhere close to it. And so he just assumed that he was going this way. So he was like, you know what? I'm going to save you the trip. So he picked it up, the turtle, and carried him to the place he supposed he was going to go. And then when he dropped it, the thing turned around and went the other way. And he was like, wait, you're supposed to go that way. And then he did it again. He dropped it. You know, he picked up and dropped it where he thought he was going. And he turned back again to go his own way. I was just saying, when you picked up that worm with the leaf, you know, maybe and delivered it to where you supposed it was going to go. Maybe he was like, oh, darn it. I was just about to get to my aunt's house. And some guy.
I left my purse. I need to go back now.
Yeah. But thanks, I want to share. I do the same thing. Like, especially after rain, you see how like earthworms, right?
Yeah.
They come out from nowhere. And a lot of them ended up on the pavement where cars and people, you know, and you know what happens after that. So whenever I see them, I use a little stick to help them, you know, to pick them up and just throw them on the soil somewhere. Maybe not exactly where they want to go, but at least they won't be squashed. But your suggestion, maybe a leaf will work better because sticks will poke them like a little bit more harshly. Yeah. So thank you for that, you know, piece of information. Anyhow.
Oh, yeah. You're listening to The Bridge.
I wanted to go back to something we said at the beginning, because I think a lot of people are confused, including me. This is something new to me. When I was reading this, I was really kind of surprised, because when you think of migratory animals, I think of maybe, I don't know, like whales or, you know, birds. But, you know, it's a lot more than that. This is from TheGuardian.com. From turtles to fruit bats, migratory species increasingly under threat, according to the United Nations. I think it's the same report influencing a lot of articles. But this one mentions nomadic fish, humpback whales, Dalmatian pelicans. And it goes on to talk about, you know, bats and all kinds of different animals in this article. And so I think we humans don't really understand when we think, oh, migratory animals, you mean like birds. But actually, there are you know, thousands of migratory animals who move around all over the planet all the time. So every time we have, oh no, we destroyed some place with an oil spill. You may not just destroy, you know, whatever fish lived there. You may be destroying entire species of fish that like live in the, you know, that entire area.
Right.
So the risk for animal extinction is really high. And there's a stat from this article. It says as much as 97% of sharks, rays, and sturgeons are on facing the list. 97% are facing high risk extinction, with populations declining by 90% since the 1970s. So imagine that we have wiped out 9 out of 10 of these animals in the last few decades. That's crazy.
Are you sure? 97% of sharks?
90%. Oh, yeah. It says as much as 90% of sharks, rays, and sturgeons on the list facing a high risk of extinction. Yeah, 97%.
And we all know that once we cut off one segment of the food chain, the rest will feel the impact, because they've just lost their food source.
Yeah.
So it's not just about that one species. And also, I read this article from, this is from conservation.org. Why is biodiversity important? Because I think, you know, we can talk about this all the time, but if we don't make people feel the impact of what this is doing, then this is just like information out there that have nothing to do with them. And in it, it mentioned that losing one, let's say one species, might not be a disaster yet, but each loss as to the likelihood of a serious problem, as I mentioned before. And if we can learn something from all that we've talked about, we know that we're not at the starting line here. We've been doing this for decades and decades and decades. Well, look, so we are at a point of a serious problem.
Well, I have an interesting metaphor. This might be a little scary, since you want to scare people.
What?
I've got an idea. So let's look at the human body as like an analogy for the earth. Let's say you just lose only your pancreas. It's just one thing. We're just going to mine there right now. The pancreas, you know, the whole body's going to be dead in like a week or two. So
good point.
You know, if you lose one single part of your body that is critical, the whole thing is gone. Or like, oh, you know, white blood cells, all of them are gone. You know,
you will die. Yeah.
You're right. Exactly. So the earth is like a giant organism. And if we remove just one or two things that are critical that we don't understand,
you know what?
That could
That's what I was thinking earlier today. And it was talking about how we are so dominated by our senses. Like, this is, you know, seeing is believing. You have to hear and see it. And that's a real limitation. As you mentioned, like, we don't even feel the inner workings of our internal organs, which is a good thing. Because once you feel something, it's likely that there's some problem there already, right? Like, you don't know. I don't even know where my pancreas is. And that's a good thing. You know, I don't even want to be made known about it. But it's a reminder that everything works together. It's just you are not conscious of it. Like, starting with the mind and body ensemble, right? It's a whole deal. Right? You can't really separate the mind from the body. I actually read somewhere that every single cell in our body has a mind of its own, like besides the mind we have for our body.
Wow.
Because you,
oh, no.
Well, they don't really.
I don't want to scratch my skin now because I'm killing something.
Well, you.
I'm
well,
so
the
sorry.
Ones are okay, but it's got a mind of its own. Yeah. So they are smart. If you look at like on the microscopic level, like if you are a molecular biologist, like I don't think like everyone would be amazed by how smart cells are. And it seems like they're just doing all these things automatically. But my point is, so besides the mind-body combination, there's also the combination of our different organs, right? The whole thing works as like an orchestra. right? Everyone has to play its part. Mm-hmm. But just because you don't see your liver or you don't feel where it is, doesn't mean it's not important. Doesn't mean you can lose it. And the same is true of the whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm. I think this idea of we are actually all connected, like it has been pounded into us for I don't know how long, probably for thousands of years, but people are still not listening. At least, you know, a huge portion is just they hear it, but they don't feel it. They don't really get it. But think of your, you know, separate organs. They're not really separate, and they are there, you know, doing their thing. That's why we are alive and feeling, you know, pretty good. So I think thinking about it from this level reminds us that the other birds or species or worms, and they might not have like a direct contact with you, like right now here, but somehow we're all interrelated and we should respect that. And it's we just don't have enough respect for how things actually work. Sorry for rambling on.
Yeah, I think on a macroscopic level, we don't. There are millions of people who do, in fact, are concerned and would like, you know, us to take more action. But on a grand scale, most people are concerned about like the new pop album coming out or the new movie coming out or like,
I wonder,
you know, their favorite flavor of
ice cream. I wonder how long it will take for humans to get tired of all this, you know, to get tired of each new iPhone that comes out, which turned out to be not so different from the one before. And each new product or each new, new fancy thing that AI can do. I feel like somewhere down the line, we're just going to be so fed up with these new additions or new minor tweaks to old ideas. And we're going to be so fed up with all the junk that we've accumulated over the years. You know, these external items and things that seem to enrich us, but at the same time, draining our precious energy and also cluttering us up. Mm-hmm. You know, don't you feel cluttered by all the things that you see around you? They serve you, but at the same time. Anyhow, sorry for complaining.
Well, I was going to say, Summer, my lovely wife, she spent a couple of weeks in Wuhan, and she's a little more cluttery than me. So in terms of clutter in my home, I have actually been getting rid of a lot of unnecessary items around the home. So the home is a lot more or less cluttered, although I did add some plants. I want to add some species that people might not realize are migratory. There are a few more species on that list that people care about a lot more than bats. So lions, gorillas, and giraffes are also migratory. Would you like to live in a world where there are no more giraffes? I don't want to live in that world. That sounds terrible. You know, there's like, what, thousands of species of bird. If you say, oh, you know, some species of bird is gone, I'm like, most people are going to register, oh, there goes another one. But if you say there are no more giraffes, I think you're going to, the world's going to pause, you know? People are going to, whoa, what happened?
That's a good point.
And like, we're going to have to reevaluate the direction of everything, because I think it really, you know, and it's really interesting. You have a daughter. Mm. You know, when I remember being your daughter's age and thinking about animals all the time, and then somehow we grow up and then you lose that fascination. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I don't sit around thinking about the awesomeness of a killer whale anymore. But I remember being 11 years old and thinking about it every day, all day. So like, I think,
you know why?
You know why?
I think the main reason is our sense of self has grown so much bigger over the years. Like the thoughts about ourselves have multiplied to take such importance. It overwhelms everything else. Because I think when kids are little, I mean, they have their needs, right? But their sense of ego wasn't as strong. So they still have space for other things and other people. They still had curiosity. And now, you know, I can sit here and spend half an hour thinking about what kind of coffee I need to get or like what kind of bubble tea I want. You know, that's very egotistic because my world, I'm so much better than before already. But I'm just saying, you know, as adults, we spend so much time thinking about ourselves, right? How much time do you spend thinking about other species like giraffes? But now that you mentioned it, I think at some point it's going to hit us. Let's say, I don't want this day to happen, but if someday in the future we read in the news that giraffes have become extinct. Yes, you are correct. I think we're going to sit back and just pause. What have we done, or what has happened to Earth, to this huge system that giraffes just can't live here anymore? And how is that different from the white rhinos? I think those are, have you heard of the white rhinos? They're only like, what, two?
One recently became pregnant about a week ago. Because they used artificial insemination to create pregnancy. So, because they're so worried that
there are only two. Like there were only two left. So someday, if we don't do anything about it, it's going to happen to the giraffe. And that, will that day be too late for us to wake up? I mean, down the line, how far are we down the line from the giraffes, if you think about it? So if we're so scared about our own our own survival, if we don't want to become an endangered species, then maybe we should start doing something now, at least change our way of thinking about it. But then, Jason, sometimes I think, oh, maybe before we get to that time, you know, artificial intelligence would have like killed us before that or some kind of nuclear threat. So,
wow, you have a you should be a writer. You have such a big imagination.
I'm sorry, but like these are things that's looming, literally looming in our world.
It's possible.
So, yeah.
Elon Musk is worried. I want to point out an article that I read and I have a problem with it. I think the author, David Helvarg, is doing a wonderful job. And I think, David, you know, keep doing what you're doing. But I also want to take issue with the fact that he needs to do it this way. There's an article from MSN.com. It's originally LA Times. It's called, "Is the Restoration of California's Cutest Keystone Species Worth It?" And it's essentially about otters. Because there used to be otters all along the California coast, from Oregon all the way down, everywhere. And now they're just 3,000. And they're mostly located in Monterey Bay. And California has made the decision to reintroduce otters across the California coast. And so obviously there's going to be pushback, like anytime you kind of do this. So there are a lot of fishermen, you know, fishing companies that are like, hey, no, you're going to make it so I can't go fishing here for like how many years? 10 years, 5 years, whatever.
I see.
And so a lot of them are taking issue with the fact that these reintroduction policies to save the California otter, a keystone species, is negatively impacting their business. So by the end of this article, our author, David Helvarg, finally makes the argument that it will add back to the economy. And he actually points out the fact that saving this species is going to essentially bring economic power back to the to California, and that there will be millions of dollars in fishing and tourism as a consequence of reintroducing the otters. So I think David did a wonderful job. But the fact that we have to make arguments this sophisticated a level just to get people to let us save the environment is troubling.
Yeah. So otters, are you saying they are getting endangered now?
Well, let's say Monterey Bay's otters are wiped out for some reason. That's it.
Have you ever seen pictures of a mom, like a mommy otter? Have you ever seen pictures of a mother otter holding her baby while they're all like floating on the river? It's such like a peaceful...
Watched otters.
Oh, well, I don't think I've ever seen a real one.
If you go to San Francisco Bay Area and you go out on Pier 39, you can stand on the end of the wooden deck. There are at least 20 to 30 otters you can view at any given time. And they're like, and pushing each other around. You can just sit there. You're literally like 5-10 meters away watching them. They're stinky and they're adorable.
Well, the pictures I've seen, like that's the definition of like chill. You know, they're just chilling. They're floating around effortlessly and carrying their baby. Usually it's a mom and one baby otter and floating like that as if there's like no worries in the world ever. So it's such a beautiful scene. And they aren't they the ones who like cut down trees really efficiently?
No, those are beavers.
Those are beavers. Oh, otters are just like, what do they do? I'm sorry. This is such a human question. What do they do?
I think otters eat fish and hang out. and like they get warm. Well, the only, I don't know much about them. I'm sure some otter expert is listening and they're thinking, you moron, Jason.
But I know.
All I've ever seen, they hang out in the sun until they get warm enough to go back into the ocean. And then they come out on, they lay on the stones or whatever until they get warm enough. Then they go back out in the ocean. So they're just mostly eating.
Yeah, they can teach us how to live better, right? You crazy people, you know, rushing on the highway and always running from here to there. Look at us. Well, I'm sure they serve an important purpose, you know, in the whole ecosystem chain. And I really hope that they do survive. I'm not too sure how they are being introduced to other places. Like, do you just take a family of otters and place them somewhere else? So hoping that they will reproduce.
I think that's exactly how you do it. Hey, how do you like your new home?
Well, they will be away from their like aunts and uncles. Hopefully you get
to
take.
I think they take a huge, there's 3,000. So you take a huge enough segment of them. I don't know how many that is. I'm not an expert. You go somewhere where there used to be otters and you introduce them and maybe feed them for a while, get them used to hanging out there and then hope that they reproduce and stay. I mean, I'm just assuming.
Play them some like old time movies, like old time otter movies to remind them that your grandpa's grandpa used to live here and they had a really good time. So you can adapt to and thrive. Good luck.
You know, they might try music, actually. You know, it's really interesting you bring up entertainment because sometimes off the coast of California, they may do this elsewhere. Mm-mm. In order to move whales from getting too close to the coast, they'll send out buoys and ships to play whale music.
That's wow.
Like, hey, let's go over here. And they'll actually draw the whales away from the coast. Hmm. So maybe they'll play like, this is my chill, cool otter home music or something.
Yeah, like this was popular back in the 30s. And here we're revisiting. That's a really good idea. You know, hopefully.
You could record music from the Monterey Bay, right? Of them all hanging out and then just play it in the new location.
As we're talking about this, I keep thinking how kids, they will respond differently from adults. Because I think if you just grab any like busy adult, let's say from the street of New York and tell them about otters and about, you know, their future habitat, I think people just look at you weird and, well, you know, just
New York
brush
is full
you away.
Of crazy people.
I know.
I want to talk to you about otters.
And how endangered they have become and play music to them. So, yeah. But then if you talk the same thing to children, like to kids, if you go to kindergarten and you tell them the same story, I think they will look at you with like eyes full of wonder and even awe because, wow, this uncle seems so wonderfully bizarre. You know, he tells us things that my parents or other people don't tell me about, and it's wonderful. I think they will be so much more receptive because, as I mentioned, they are not as filled with ideas about me yet. And they still have space to, you know, to love and to love the rest of the world a little bit more. So I think we'll, you know, we can have more hope, right, in the next generation and the next, especially talk to them about this when they are still kids, so that they have more love for the wilderness, for other species that they never heard of, so that they will feel sad if they know of the possibility that, hey, one day, if we don't take care of the world, maybe the giraffes will disappear. You know, which child won't be touched?
I mean, I like that, but they were saying that in the 1980s. In the 1980s, I remember adults saying, you know, when you kids grow up, you're going to have to do, you know, fix all the stuff we've messed up. And now I'm an adult, right? I'm middle-aged. I'm approaching 50. And we're now if we say, oh, it's up to the kids, I think it's too late. I think we
good point.
Now, like as a world, need to build forums and get together. Oh, there's another article. This is ifaw.org, International Journal. So it's a scientific journal. 10, and this goes back to what you said at the beginning of the show, 10 of the most endangered animals in Australia. And these are endangered. So I was actually surprised. Number one, koalas.
Koalas.
I don't want to live in a world without koalas. I've never even seen a koala, but I don't want to. Yeah, I want to know they're out there somewhere.
They have like different animals. I think there's this one called something, something devil. What's the name of that particular?
Tasmanian devil. Yeah.
It's become endangered. And I was like, okay, does it have something to do with their name? Like, if they're called like Tasmania angels, will they live better? Like, will people feel better about themselves? So I actually searched for their pictures, and they look like little, like they have the face of a bear, like a grizzly bear, or like black. In China, we have these like black bears, and their face look like that, but they're much tinier, and they have like a white ring of white fur around their chest. So all these like animals that you've never seen before, they exist somewhere. And let's not like threaten them just because we want an extra steak or we want like whatever, plasticky things. But, you know, before our time runs out, I want to share another point that I read in one of these articles. This one is from conservation.org. So at one point, if people are wondering how, let's say, deforestation could impact our lives directly, here's one point. So deforestation, like cutting down trees, has been accelerating climate breakdown, which in turn may boost the spread of disease, by allowing disease carriers like mosquitoes to extend their geographic ranges and infect new populations of humans. So in other words, these mosquitoes, they were happy living in some forest before, right? Bothering, I don't know, like other animals, sheep and cows and others we've never heard of. You know, they were happy there. But then if you cut down all the trees and the mosquitoes don't have as much of a, as large of a place to live, they're going to start going to your villages and eventually cities, and they might be carrying things. Actually, there's another term that I got to know today. It's called zoonosis.
Yes.
Well, this was a new word for me. It refers to any disease or infection that's naturally transmissible from vertebrate animals to humans. And now there are over 200 known types of zoonosis. And it comprises a large percentage of new and existing diseases in humans, such as rabies. Like, that's from dogs, I think, right? But there are others. Mm-hmm. And if the ecosystem breaks down even more, we might, you know, face an increase of the types of diseases from other animals because they're forced to live closer to us. So we will be at the risk of getting too close to these animals and the things that they might transmit. They probably will be okay with whatever viruses they live with, but we will not be okay if we get too close. So stop cutting down.
Well, that's a really good point. I think that goes back to a thread that we pulled through the entire show, and that is, if we keep messing with the environment, we don't understand the full consequences of how that's going to impact, you know, us at the mall.
Right.
But okay, we are, like you said, we are out of time. So folks, if you want to reach out to us and let us know what you think about endangered animals and how we should move forward, please email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. Or you could just tell us why we're wrong about everything we've said. We'd be happy to read that on the air too. Thank you so much for your time, listeners. Thank you so much for your time, baby.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. And we'll see you guys next time. Bye-bye.